But yeah, I can hear you.
So let's go ahead and get started. Again, a little bit of echo there, but so I've been working on some notes for this map derivation, but I'm not really happy with them yet. And so what I thought I'd do today is to go through this paper, which is the seminal paper on the work, and kind of lay out the different pieces of this derivation. But I think what we're going to need to do, I think what would be useful for you is if we then backtrack a little bit and talk about some of the pieces of this derivation, which involved, I think, statistical techniques that you probably haven't seen before. Certainly we don't teach, as far as I know, we don't teach these kinds of things here in most of our classes. Because I think they're useful things to know, and they're used quite a lot in this kind of literature. So, and I think we'd all benefit from seeing more details on these. So I'll go through the derivations today, but there's a couple points that are going to be, I think, difficult to comprehend, and we'll continue to work through those topics. So next class, I'll try to fill in some of the details on some of the background, and the following class we'll begin discriminative training. That's sort of the way I see things. Now, we sent out yesterday, I think it was, this example that Sundar worked up. Did people get a chance to look at that? Not yet, okay. You're making this hard. Because in that example, he actually uses a couple of the concepts that are central to this derivation. And we're also still in the process of cleaning that derivation up to make it a little more readable and a little easier to understand. So, sort of consider this work in progress. But the results that we've derived are it's sort of interesting because you know the answer. It's just trying to convince you that these answers actually make theoretical sense is what's a little bit harder with these derivations. In a lot of one of the problems I have with the literature, I was talking actually to the author of this paper who. It's a fairly well-known lab in France. I was talking to him last night. And, the problem with this particular area is that there's never really been a really good end-to-end textbook documentation of these derivations, but everybody knows and uses the results. So you look across a lot of different lectures at a lot of different universities, and you see the end results, but you don't really see the derivations because probably there's only a few people who've actually worked through all the details on these things. But the derivations are important because these concepts are used repeatedly throughout most of the work on Bayesian modeling that has been so popular for the last 10 years or so in the signal processing literature. So I'll sort of work from the console here because I need to manipulate the display. But so let's begin with we have our standard map formulation where we're going to try to maximize this posterior. Is that large enough? Can people see that okay? Or do I need to increase the size a little bit? Should I magnify a little bit? So this paper, by the way, this paper is in, it's on the website, and it's in the archive directory, which you have to reach by using a password. It's also linked from the lecture notes. So we're going to begin by the usual map formulation where we've got the product of the likelihood and the prior on the parameters, and we're going to try to maximize this. In this particular paper, instead of using O for observations, they use X for feature vectors. So that's one notational difference. And instead of using, we use P for the probability density function, they'll use F. And I think I've been thinking about that. I think one of the reasons people like to do that is because often we end up optimizing a likelihood function, not the density function, so that they use F, I guess. And as we've talked about, There's, of course, the there's the usual problems with this. That what are the things we need to know to be able to proceed? Well, we need to know something about the prior distribution g of theta, and we need to know something about the density function, the observations given the model or given the parameters. So we know that for the observations, we're pretty comfortable with the fact that we're going to model this with a multivariate Gaussian, right? And we've talked about that now a couple times. In this particular formulation, we're actually going to use a mixture of Gaussians, which is sort of a nice generalization of a Gaussian distribution. The problem really comes with, what do we assume for this G? And I have to say, that's sort of one of the areas that I'm still kind of struggling with, that to me it would seem reasonable to assume multivariate Gaussian distributions for G as well. But if you do that, then you don't end up with a reasonable solution. So unfortunately, you know, I'm still kind of, like I said, trying to come up with good arguments for this. What's done with G is to use several types of distributions from the statistics literature, and there's some argument for why they're using these distributions, and we'll see those in a moment. But I would have to say that the main argument seems to be that if you use these distributions, which are called, we'll see, are called conjugate priors, you end up with a tractable solution to the problem. And, you know, I'm still struggling with that, because you hate to make assumptions about your data just to get a solution to a problem, right? But on the other hand, some solution is better than no solution. And I've been trying to think about the implications of that with respect to particular applications like speech processing, and I don't know. It's an area of exploration. I think that's one of the reasons why, since MAP was introduced, people have introduced extensions to it that relax some of these assumptions. But nevertheless, we'll proceed. We're going to need to fill in some information about those two distributions. Okay, so let's we'll tackle first the density function, the likelihood, essentially. Now, in the paper, they talk a little bit about sufficient statistics and such. I think interesting stuff, but I don't know that we need to digress to that extent on that particular topic. So for the likelihoods, we're going to assume a mixture of Gaussians. And what that simply means is we have a sum of Gaussians which are weighted by this parameter omega sub k. Omega sub k is called the mixture coefficient. And typically, when we make this formulation, there's also an additional constraint that omega sub k, the sums of the omega sub k's, is equal to 1. So normally what happens is that at a state in an HMM, if you're thinking about it in that context, at each state you'll have a weighted sum of these Gaussian distributions as the output distribution. In the context here, we can just think of this as a generalized Gaussian model. Instead of having one Gaussian, a weighted sum of Gaussians is a much more powerful way to model different kinds of distributions. So if your data is not Gaussian, you can show under some constraints that this sum of weighted Gaussians can approximate just about any probability distribution shape. And that's one of the reasons why these mixtures are popular, because they can deal with the fact, they can model non-Gaussian distributions. But that comes at an expense, because for each one of these Gaussians, you have a mean vector and potentially a covariance matrix. And that's a large number of parameters because you have the dimension of the mean vector is the same dimension as your feature vectors. That could be, you know, typically about 40 or 100. And then your covariance matrix is that squared, so you've got 100 squared. So it's a lot of parameters per Gaussian. And then you may have 100 of these Gaussians per state in a real system. So that's a lot of parameters. It's a fairly complex model, but that's what we're able to do today with the power that we have in our computers. So we're going to, in addition to wanting to adapt the means and covariances, we're also going to have to adapt the mixture coefficients. And I thought about, actually in my notes I was working through derivation without the mixtures, because I think that adds a somewhat unnecessary level of complexity. But most of the derivations of this type, you'll see people using these mixture distributions. So our parameter vector then, the theta, then becomes a concatenation of the mixture coefficients, the means, and the covariance matrices. Now there's another little interesting twist on this model, which it seems to be more common in this literature than I would have expected, which is that this R is actually what they call a precision matrix, and it's the inverse of the covariance matrix. So normally we would have the inverse of the covariance matrix here on the quadratic term for the Gaussian, and we'd have the 1 over the determinant of the covariance matrix. But for some reason, they estimate, rather than estimating the inverse of the, rather than estimating the covariance matrix, we end up estimating the inverse of the covariance matrix. I'm not completely sure why that is, other than maybe it's numerical issues, or it's just the equations for that turn out to be a little simpler. But we'll actually end up with an estimate of the covariance matrix. So I don't know, they could have probably done a derivation using the inverse covariance matrix. Okay, so we've discussed now the one component of that product, which is the likelihood. That's sort of the easy part. Now the harder part, and this is one of the areas where I think there's more background is essential, is what we do about the, so now we need prior distributions, we need the G of theta. For the G of theta, what are the things we have to worry about? We have to worry about the mixture coefficients, and we have to worry about the prior values for the means, prior values for the covariances. So the obvious thing to do would be to throw all those into a multivariate Gaussian distribution, but then you'd have to worry about correlations between the mixture coefficients, between the means, between the variances. There's no way we would ever know all that information. And on top of that, if we ended up with such a complicated mixture distribution, we would not end up with relatively simple adaptation equations. So what's done is to assume that we tend to always with the Gaussians make these independence assumptions. So the first step is to say, well, let's assume that G of theta can be factored into a prior on the mixture coefficients, a prior on the means and variances. We sort of decouple those two and deal with them independently. Then in addition to that, we're going to assume that the priors on the mixture coefficients can be decomposed into a product of the priors on each of the individual mixture coefficients. And so that's, you know, yet another sort of independence assumption. And then on top of that, we are going to assume a form of that distribution, which is called a Dirichlet density. And what it consists of is a product of the mixture coefficient omega sub k raised to the new sub k minus 1 power, where the nus represent the prior value and the omegas represent the new value that you're trying to estimate. So this is essentially writing this density as a function of the new value and the previous value. It's conditioning the new value based on the previous value. Now, this is a little bit difficult to explain, other than this builds on this concept of a conjugate density, or what's called a conjugate prior. Conjugate priors are a fairly new concept. I don't remember if they were introduced in the 80s or the 90s, but it's something that seems to be integral to Bayesian modeling. Sundar's handout, one of the reasons I asked if you'd read that, Sundar's handout talked a little bit about that, just very briefly. And the conjugate prior, the idea there is that you want, if you know the form, you have a posterior is the product of a likelihood and a prior, right? And we're often trying to estimate the posteriors directly. That's, for example, what neural networks do or other things. We often know the likelihood function because we make some assumption about multivariate Gaussian or such. But the prior distribution, we often have to make some assumptions about. The property of a conjugate prior, they call it that because if the goal with a conjugate prior is that the shape of the prior distribution and the shape of the posterior will be the same, even though the posterior is the product of a Gaussian times some other distribution. Now, why would we want such a thing? Well, we want such a thing because that often allows tractable solutions to problems because you can equate, you can do a functional equating of the posterior and the prior because you have essentially these two forming the same shape. And we'll see that that's actually used in this derivation and it's used in other places. Now, there are some very well-known, in the statistics literature, very well-known conjugate prior distributions, and this Dirichlet density is one of them. Dirichlet density is used when you're dealing with a multinomial density. So there's some discussion here to try to motivate modeling the mixture coefficients as a multinomial. Multinomial is just a multi-parameter version of a binomial distribution, and binomial distributions tend to be used when you're dealing with counts. Or, and, you know, for example, in communications theory, when you're looking at distributions of bits and things, you see binomials often used. So since these mixture coefficients, we estimate these essentially by trying to estimate the number of times a particular distribution is used over the number of times it could be used, these are often considered as counts. And therefore, it makes some sense to try to model them as multinomial density, which means then we're going, if we use a conjugate prior, if we use a Dirichlet density for the conjugate prior, some tractable mathematics should result. So, I don't know if that made any sense, but that's why that's being used. So the next thing we have to worry about is the means and the covariances, right? So we've got now the prior consists of priors on the mixture coefficients, priors on the means, and priors on the covariances. So the next thing we have to worry about then is the shape of the prior for the means and covariances. Now, for this, we invoke this concept of a conjugate prior again, and we use what's known as a Wishart density. It's a function which, when we multiply this with the Gaussian likelihood, the posterior is going to be of the same form as this, and therefore we have this nice symmetry between the posterior and the prior, and again, that'll allow us to solve for some of the parameters associated with these functions because we can equate what amounts to equate polynomials, and we'll see that exploited a little bit later. So the Wishart density for these means and covariances, it's of an exponential form, and it consists of, we have the determinant of the covariance matrix raised to this alpha sub k minus p over 2 power. I'll comment on that a little bit more in a second. And then we have this exponential, we have a quadratic form, which is the means minus the m's are the new means, the mu's are the old means. So we have the means minus the new means minus the old means. The old means are, I really should say, this is the true mean. This is sort of what we know from prior knowledge. And the m's are what we're trying to actually estimate with the map estimation. And the r's are the new means. I mean, the r's are the new covariances. And this matrix U, which we'll see on the last term, represents the prior on the covariance. So we have this exponential term, which is a quadratic on, this is essentially the difference of the estimate of our new mean from the prior mean. And then we have this term, which is on the end, which is the exponential of the trace of this covariance matrix of the from the prior. This is essentially, you could think of this as the old or the true covariance times the covariance matrix that we're trying to estimate. Now, the form of this distribution is also something I want to add a little more detail on next class.
It's the RK is the inverse of the covariance matrix.
Yeah, it's actually the right. I'm sorry. Yeah, it's actually the. I'm gonna. I keep making. You know, it's actually the inverse of the covariance matrix, and therefore this is often written as the inverse of a matrix times the matrix. So I think for some reason, like I said, they're choosing to do the use R as the inverse of the covariance matrix, so things are sort of inverted. Now, one of the things I'm actually still struggling with, I'm trying to come up with a good, clean explanation of this, and there's two parameters here that are introduced. Scalars, this alpha sub k and this tau sub k. And the alpha sub k is essentially related to the number of feature vectors that you have. It's often called the degrees of freedom. And in this formulation, alpha sub k has to be greater than p minus 1 so that this term here doesn't go to zero, but I'm sort of struggling with why that alpha sub k should not just be the number of feature vectors. I don't know, Sundar, if you have any insight on that, because you had the same problem with your derivation.
Of course, for scalar case.
Yeah, for the scalar case, it's easy because it goes away.
Right. Yeah.
But like, that's one area where I want to get you a little more information. Similarly, the tau, in the final equations, there's a nice interpretation of tau in terms of an adaptation speed or an adaptation constant. But again, I'm not quite sure why that has to be introduced at this point. It just adds another degree of freedom and another parameter to be estimated in this distribution. So I'm still working on a more clarification of that. That's one of my stumbling points. I have a feeling the answer is they want this here because they want, in the final solution, they want some ability to control the way the mixing of the old estimates and the new estimates. But I don't have a good justification yet for why that's in that distribution. Now, as we mentioned earlier, we're going to assume independence between the prior on the mixture coefficients and the prior on the means and covariances. So we're going to write the overall prior g of theta as a product of the prior on the mixture coefficients, and now we have a product of these priors on the means and covariances because we have these k mixtures at each state, or we have k mixtures to deal with. And in fact, the priors on the mixture coefficients is actually a product of the individual priors on each of the scalar coefficients. So you've got kind of a product times a product there. So now we have everything defined, And the question is, how do we estimate this from the data? So for that, we're going to use EM. But there's a couple subtleties to applying EM to this problem. First of all, we're dealing with, in this particular case, here we're dealing with just estimates of a multivariate Gaussian. Later we'll see estimates of an HMM. Even with the case of the multivariate Gaussian, we don't often know when you have an incoming feature vector, you don't know which Gaussian it corresponds to exactly. You don't know which of the Gaussians in your mixture distribution was used to generate that feature vector. Because that feature vector could have been generated by any of your Gaussians with some probability. So the label, what we call the labels, which refer to the specific mixture component that was used to generate that data point, that becomes one of these what we call the hidden states. We don't really know what those are, so our general strategy is going to be to assume it could have been generated by any one of these and to try to estimate essentially the probability that it could have been generated from any one of these distributions. So that puts this EM in, sort of casts it in this framework where we have sort of what's called the complete data likelihood and the incomplete data. So I just wanted to sort of mention that because in this case, the form of the likelihood, the form of the auxiliary function that we're going to minimize is going to involve our traditional auxiliary function, Q of theta hat, which represents the what's often called the complete data log this is the auxiliary function that we've seen before, but we also have this additional term, which is the expectation of some mapping between the parameters and these hidden labels and the data itself. And that's sort of the hidden element of this model, and we're going to have to minimize the sum of these two in our EM formulation. And we'll see in a moment sort of how that works, but this is the Q function is the one we've already seen, and we'll expand that in a moment. But we have this additional term which describes the mapping between the data and the labels that, because we don't know which specific mixture component actually produced the data. Okay, so our strategy is going to be to minimize the sum of these two, and we're going to do this using log likelihoods, and this is another sort of standard thing. We know that the form of these distributions are exponentials, so if we minimize the product, we have the sum of the arguments. So if we do this in the log domain, then we can separate the Q function from this prior, essentially, because remember we had the likelihood times the prior, so the log of a product is the sum of the logs. So the auxiliary function is defined as the sum of the logs of these distributions. Now later, what's sort of funny about this is later we're actually going to define another auxiliary function, which is the exponential of R. So we're sort of going back and forth between the sum of the logs and the product of the distributions themselves. So for the likelihood part of this, the Q function, we have these K mixture densities, and we have these K mixture weights associated with those densities, And the auxiliary function is essentially going to be this weighted sum. We've got the cross entropy weighted by the probability of each one of the mixture coefficients. So the I can sort of explain the components of this with lecture 10, with equation 10. So we have omega sub k hat. These are the mixture coefficients we're trying to estimate. These are the hats in this derivation. The hat represents the old model, the theta represents the new model. We're actually going to use a tilde to represent the new estimates of the parameters, as I recall. But so we have in the numerator here, we have this term, which is the mixture coefficient times the probability of the data being generated by the kth mixture coefficient divided by this denominator term, I'll come back to that in a second, times the log of that probability, the mixture coefficient times the probability that the kth component generated the data. So this f of x given theta, this is essentially the kth mixture coefficient. It's a multivariate Gaussian. We're waiting, since there's k of these, we could just assume they're all equally probable. But instead, we want to actually allow for them to not be equally probable, and therefore we have the mixture coefficient weighting. And we're essentially going to weight each one of these by the probability that coefficient, that kth distribution could have generated the data. So we essentially have a weighted sum here, which is the probability of the kth distribution divided by the total probability of any of those distributions. Now, that's actually done with respect to the posterior. So we have the probability that distribution generated the data factored into this. Instead of just omega sub k over the sum of the omegas, we actually weight this by the probability that kth distribution could have generated that particular data point. And then we also have, in the form of this, we have the p of theta times log p of theta, because that's our cross entropy type term. But you'll also notice that the log here has, we have theta hat times the log, we have this sort of p of theta hat times the log of p of theta. So we have that cross entropy type construction. And then, as I mentioned, we're going to go back and forth between this r function, which is a sum of the logs, and this phi function, which is an exponential of r, which is the products of the distributions. Okay, so now we're going to define some intermediate variables that are going to be used in the to simplify the re-estimation equations. The first, and these actually have analogies. These sort of come from the Baum-Welsch implementation of the EM algorithm, so they're sort of drawing parallels to those. So we have this C sub KT, which is essentially the probability of the kth mixture distribution generating a vector, a feature vector X sub T, weighted by the mixture coefficient for that kth distribution. So this is, you could say, in some sense, the number of times that the kth distribution was actually taken. If we sum those over t, we have the total number of times that the kth distribution was taken over all of the data. If we can also compute a weighted weighted mean, which we're going to call x sub k bar, and this can be interpreted as the the sort of the weighted sum, the weighted mean of all the feature vectors associated with the kth mixture. And if we sum that over time, we then get the sample mean of that. So this is essentially weighting the, for the kth mixture coefficient, this is an, you can think of this as an estimate of the mean of that kth Gaussian, but it's computed not simply by taking the average of all the data assigned to that kth Gaussian, because we don't really know which data belongs to which Gaussian, so we're essentially weighting that by the frequency with which that Gaussian occurs. So this is essentially a weighted mean. And then we have a similar computation for the covariance estimate. We have x sub t minus x sub k bar. But again, we have that computation weighted by the number of times that that kth Gaussian is actually used. And this expression for this covariance matrix can be decomposed into it can actually be written in terms of the covariance matrix. We can write that this C sub K times M minus X sub K transpose times the inverse covariance matrix times M sub K minus X sub K bar. This is the sort of normal quadratic term plus the trace of this this covariance matrix S sub K times the inverse covariance matrix R sub K. That's an identity which is used in this derivation and fairly well, I guess it's, you know, it's an identity that's fairly well known for these types of quadratic forms involving covariances. Now the next part gets a little bit tricky, but it it draws on this concept of a conjugate prior, and what we're going to observe is that this auxiliary function psi is proportional to, we have the prior g of theta, and we have the which is the prior for, and then we have the we have this conjugate prior for the means and covariances. And because there's this property of the conjugate prior that the shape of psi has to be equal to the shape of this prior, you can actually take these two functions which have the same shape and essentially equate coefficients of their arguments. Now the derivation of this is not omitted in the paper, of course, and I think that's another one of these little details that makes it a little hard to understand this, but when you do that, what we end up with are, you have things on the left we're going to denote as the new estimates, primes, in terms of things on the right. So that allows us to essentially equate or create, if you will, new estimation equations. Remember that we're trying to essentially maximize this distribution, and we're trying to find the values of theta that maximize that distribution. So by equating these two distributions, we can write that we have this vk prime is equal to v sub k plus c sub k. And remember that the v's are the priors on the mixture weights. We have this constant tau also has a similar form. And we have the tau and alpha. And then we have probably the most significant piece of this is the new estimate of the mean is equal to this tau times the old estimate of the mean plus c sub k times the sample mean over this tau sub k plus c sub k. So this is essentially very similar to the re-estimation equation for the mean that we derived in the scalar case. if you look at what's going on here, we have a mixture of the prior mean and the sample mean. And those are mixed by the C sub K's are pretty clear. That's the number of times that sample mean is actually occurring. So we have, and we essentially have, so we're mixing the two by a term which is proportional to the number of times that kth Gaussian is actually occurring. Unfortunately, I still don't have a good explanation for the taus, other than the taus are actually going to be proportional to the prior information. So this is essentially, it's of the same form as what we derived for the map estimate, but it's not, we don't have the exact same equations in terms of, for example, the number of sample points and such. And that's why I want to trace back to that, where these taus were introduced, and come up with a better explanation of why that parameter was introduced, because that parameter does carry down into this equation, and it's fairly crucial to this equation. But it's hard to motivate here. And so let's just, we'll leave that as something to be further explored. And then this U, which is this covariance matrix from the prior, that's also estimated as the old covariance matrix plus this S sub K plus a weighted version of the prior mean minus the sample mean times that transpose. So this becomes an update equation for the covariance matrix because it's essentially expressing that in terms of the contribution of the new data weighted by the number of times that kth Gaussian is actually occurring.
So that's a little bit hard to follow. Well, not a lot hard to follow, but the form of the solution is what's expected. So this essentially, those equations that we just showed are the equations that result when you're just trying to model a data sequence by a mixture of Gaussians. And that's sort of the simplest thing that you could do. Now, what's traditionally done with this is to introduce this adaptation in the context of a hidden Markov model, because we want to be able to exploit the modeling properties of a hidden Markov model. And that simply adds, it adds a level of complexity, because now we have these Gaussians associated with states in the hidden Markov model. They're not directly associated with the data. And now, in addition to not knowing which of the K Gaussians generated the data, we also have to worry about which of the states generated the data. At what time were you in what state to generate the data? So that adds another level of indirection. Fortunately, though, the solution to these problems can be cast in terms of the traditional Baum-Welsh solution to re-estimating HMM parameters, and we can actually arrive at fairly nice, straightforward ways to estimate these counts and these parameters and such using what's known, using a variant of the Baum-Welsh algorithm. So what I'd like to do now is just to sort of walk through that. It's not so much a derivation, but it's really just applying this way to estimate the Gaussian mixtures in the context of an HMM. So if you recall, with the HMM, we had essentially three components. We have the prior probabilities of each state. We have a matrix A, which represents the transition probabilities of each state in the transition probabilities from one state to the next in the Markov model. And then we have the parameters theta, which are the mixture distributions associated with each state in the Hinn-Markov model. At each state, we will assume that there are k mixture coefficients, k mixture coefficients at every state. Now, that's another one of these assumptions that you can actually back off of, and you could actually let the number of mixture coefficients at each state vary. And there's no reason those need to be the same across the model. In most applications, we work in speech processing, we tend to keep the number of mixtures at each state constant, but we actually cluster all these distributions in various ways to reduce the parameter count to achieve some sort of flexibility at each state. And you could also estimate, I suppose it would be possible to derive a way to estimate the number of Gaussians at each state, also using this kind of a map estimation. But I don't know that, I don't know if anyone's done that, and if they have, it's not been widely used. So now for the sample data, we still have the same deal. We still have T feature vectors. But for the what's called the complete data, in addition to having the feature vectors and the mixture coefficient labels, we now have the state labels as well. So the S, which are another set of unobserved or unknown or hidden parameters, we have these T indices corresponding to the specific state sequence that was taken to produce these vectors X1 through XT. Now, unfortunately, we don't know what that is. So again, we're going to have to, instead of choosing a particular state sequence, we're going to have to consider all possible state sequences and sum up the probabilities of all possible state sequences. And that's what the Baum-Welsh algorithm is really suited for. And, okay, so we've got now, in addition to feature vectors and mixture coefficient labels, we've also got state labels to worry about. So this auxiliary function, or the likelihood, if you remember now, the auxiliary function had two terms. It had the term associated with Q and this term associated with something we called H, the likelihood of the complete data. So this H function, in the case of the Markov models, is going to be the probability of observing a sequence X, observing a particular state sequence S, and observing a set of likelihood labels L given the model. And that's going to be, because this is a hidden Markov model, that's essentially the initial probability times the sequence of states that were taken. So as you transition from one state to the next, that generates a transition probability, which we call A. And you'll notice the subscripts on A are S of t minus 1, S of t. That just denotes transition from state S of t minus 1 to S of t, or from I to J. And we have then, and when you're at that state, we have to worry about the probability that that feature vector was generated by the Lth Gaussian. So we have omega sub S of t, L sub t. This is the Lth mixture component at the S of t state. And we have then the probability generated by the Gaussian f of x sub t given theta sub s sub t and l sub t. Now, that's a mouthful, but the total, remember that we don't know the specific state sequence that was taken, nor do we know the specific set of Gaussians that were used to generate each one of these feature vectors. So we actually have to sum over all possible state sequences, over all possible Gaussians, and that's why in a moment you'll see we have these triple sums. So if you remember, we're going to take the we've got this product, and if we take the log of the product, we can then, if we operate in the log space, we can decompose this into a sum of the products, a sum of the terms instead of the products. So this that second term in the auxiliary function was the expectation of the log of h. And that's going to give us then this function, which is the sum of the prior probabilities times the sum of the transition probabilities. Now, another complicating factor in this, if there aren't enough already, is that now we've got these additional parameters associated with the HMM, the transition probabilities and the initial probabilities. And it would be correct to also have to worry about prior distributions of these. But we're going to assume that these parameters are fixed and known. What's actually done in a lot of these approaches is you don't estimate all the parameters simultaneously. You estimate one set assuming the others are fixed, and then you estimate the others assuming the previous were fixed. So we will end up with estimation equations for the parameters of the HMM. But we're essentially, once again, decoupling these, and we're not trying to estimate all of these simultaneously. So the prior probabilities and the transition probabilities, these again are, you can think of these in the context of these multinomial densities. So we're going to also use the Dirichlet dense conjugate prior for these, like we did with the mixture weights, so that we can hopefully end up with a tractable solution for estimating these. So the prior for these parameters then becomes a product of, we have the priors times the g of theta, the parameters for the specific distribution, times the transition probabilities. So we've added an additional set of parameters that have to be estimated, but fortunately they're somewhat decoupled from our existing prior for the Gaussians, so that we hopefully will end up with a set of decoupled equations to estimate these. Now there's two there's two ways to estimate these. The preferred way is to use the EM algorithm, which results in you essentially using the Baum-Welsh algorithm to estimate some of these probabilities. So if we do that, remember, since we decoupled these into the products, if we then optimize the log of the products, then we have the sum of these terms individually. So we end up with these decoupled auxiliary functions. And that's important because that means we could essentially differentiate with respect to one of these. For example, if we differentiate with respect to transition probabilities and the rest, and not have to worry about the coupling between these. So the auxiliary function has several components to it. The first component, which is related to the transition probabilities. And this is essentially of the form P log P, where we have the probability of, if you look at a specific, you want to re-estimate a specific transition probability from one, the transition from state S sub T minus 1. So at time T minus 1, we're in state I. At time T, we're in state J. And at that state, we output the feature vector X according to the model lambda hat. So we have that probability times the log of that probability. And then we have to sum that over all of time because we want to get all of the state transitions. We want to sum that over all of the states, we have to sum that over all of the states J, all the states we could transition to from I to state J. We also want to sum that over I for all of the states I, and then we have to sum that over T for all of the states T. Now, this is essentially taking into account all possible ways the sequence could have been generated for all possible state transitions from state I to state J over all of time. So we have the double sum over all the states because we have to account for every transition from one state to the next. And then we have the sum over all of time because we have to account for the fact that any of these states is probable at any point in time. And we can write as the sum over the states of this Q sub A, where Q sub A is essentially the probability of being in state I, the probability of transitioning from state I to state J at time T times the log of that transition probability. The A's are associated with the existing model, and the chi here is what we're trying to estimate from the new data. Similarly, for the thetas are going to be related to the Gaussians. We have the same kind of thing. We have the probability of being in state I at time t, outputting the kth Gaussian in state I at time t, given the data and given the model, times the log of the mixture weight W sub I k times the density function f of x sub t given theta I k. So this is the kth Gaussian at the ith state. This is essentially the probability that that feature vector belongs to the kth Gaussian at the ith state. And then we have to sum that over all the Gaussians at that state, over all the states, and then over all of time. So that we can write as the sum from I is equal to 1 to n of this q sub theta sub I, which is a function of this is the total accumulated, this total accumulated probability, if you will, or entropy at each state. So this is nice because we sort of have a decoupling of the two. And we have this now in terms of these variables, psi and or psi, I guess, and gamma, and we have them in terms of, for example, with the parameters for the Gaussians, we have this auxiliary, this weighted likelihood that has the mixture weight times the distribution over the sum of those over all the Gaussians at that state. And so this represents the total accumulated auxiliary function associated with the ith state for the Gaussians, and the other term represents what we've accumulated in terms of transition probabilities. So this is essentially the total accumulated contribution to Q for the transition probabilities, and then we also have the total accumulated Q for the output distribution. So it sort of decouples the hidden Markov model from the output distributions. Now, if we go ahead and maximize these, the derivation follows similar what we did for the Gaussian case, because it turns out these auxiliary functions are of the same form as what we had for the Gaussian case. So we arrive at the re-estimation equations for the various parameters of the model. Now, of course, there's a fair amount of work that was skipped to get to this point, but we can spend a little bit of time just looking at these and trying to understand the significance of these. So these, so we have essentially these five equations. The pi's represent the initial probability that you start in any one of the states in the hidden Markov model. The a's represent the probability that you transition from one state to the next. The omegas represent the mixture coefficient weights. The m's represent the means of the mixture distributions. And the r inverses represent the covariance matrix. And you can see that each one of these equations has a form that's very similar to what we derived for the basic simple map estimation case. For example, the mean equation, the fourth one down, expresses the new mean as a weighted sum of the sample mean, the sums of C sub I, K, T, X sub T, plus the prior mean, mu I, K, and we have this weighting that reflects the expected number of times that particular Gaussian mixture component was being used over the total number of times that it could have been used. The only complicating factor in this is this value tau, which can be thought of as an adaptation constant. And Sundar, it's my understanding that this is actually just a parameter that you set a priori.
Yeah.
It's a belief. And that's, I think, if you now sort of go all the way back to the beginning, I think that's why they introduced that into that distribution, because they wanted some kind of knob here.
How much you made the prior, and how much
right.
You made the negative.
But what I'm still not comfortable with is when we did the basic map derivation, we didn't use that term. So what we had here was just a mixing of the two that was essentially a weighting based on the number of times that the number of data points we have, n.
Right.
Here they're going more to a formulation where you have sort of explicit control over the weighting, and I'm sure there's a good reason.
Even there, I think it depends upon the amount of training data that you had.
Yeah, n, right.
Yeah, if you know that will translate to the same thing. If you know the training data, the amount of training data, you can still use that as the weighting factor.
Right, so that's why in a lot of formulations, you'll just see people will write a capital N there.
Right, yeah.
But in this, but if you, I guess that's a good point. If you don't know, if you want to adapt online and you don't know how much total data you're going to have, you can just set this to be, I think it's typically set to, what, a number between 0 and 1 or something like that. So the mean has a fairly straightforward interpretation once you go through 15 pages of mathematics. Then the covariance matrix, so remember they started with this R, which was the inverse of the covariance matrix. So R inverse is actually estimating the covariance matrix directly. Now, here we see that again, we have the prior covariance matrix, and then we have a term which is associated with the sample, with your, you have all these new feature vectors, and you're computing the covariance of those relative to the mean that you previously estimated. Now, I think that's an important observation, that this shows you, by decoupling these, we actually have a sort of a sequential process. You estimate the mean, and then you take that estimated mean, you update the covariance matrix based on the new data and some probability or some weight associated with how many, what the probability of that new data was, the C sub IKT. You sum that over time, and then you also have this term which was related to that trace that we have, and you have this adaptation constant times the covariance of the old mean minus the new estimate of the mean, old mean minus the new estimate of the mean transpose. So this is sort of another correctional term for the covariance matrix that's related to how far your new estimate of the mean is from your previous estimate of the mean. And then that's divided by this term alpha sub ik minus p, which is p was the dimension of the feature vector. Again, I believe the alphas are something that we just set experimentally, because that could be related to the number of data points. But again, if we don't know that ahead of time, we can just establish that as a constant. And then we have this total sum of the number of times the k mixture component is being used at the United States. So we have this, that forms the basis for the weighted sums of the correctional terms to the covariance matrix. And again, we have these constants, these adaptation constants, which allow us to control how much we weight the old data versus the new data. Then we have a similar re-estimation equation for the mixture density counts in terms of the mixture density weights. In terms of the nu sub I sub k minus 1, these are essentially the old weights minus 1 plus, and then we have that weighted sum of the number of times the kth Gaussian was taken at the ith state, divided by the total number of times it could have been taken, summed over all of time. And again, we have sort of a mixing of those. We have an estimate of that from the previous model, if you will, and an estimate from the new model. So there's sort of, again, a mixing of the old estimates altered by the number of times the number of times that Gaussian could have been used according to the new data. And since these omegas have this constraint that they have to sum to 1, the form of this adaptation is a little different than what we see for the means, but that's only because we have these additional constraints that the omegas have to be between 0 and 1, and the omegas also have to sum to be equal to 1. So that's how we update the mixture distributions at each state and the weights associated with the mixture distributions. We also then have the updates for the transition probabilities. And those, again, are of a form similar to what we see for the weights. where these eta sub ij's are, these represent the old estimates for the transition probabilities, and these psi sub ijt's are essentially the probability that that state was taken, that we transition from state I to state J at time T, summed over all of time, divided by the probability that that state, that we transition from state I to any state J. So this is the number of times we could have transitioned to state, we could have made the transition from I to J, and the numerator term is the number of times we actually made the transition from I to J. Now, the only difference is these are not formally counts, these are probabilities, because we had to compute, since we don't know what specific transition was taken, we have to compute these as probabilities. And these terms, these psi's, are estimated as part of the normal von Welch training process. And then we have a similar re-estimation equation for the initial state probabilities, the probability we began in a particular state. And again, that's a ratio of these terms gamma. The gammas are also the estimates of the initial state probabilities formed from the von Welch training. And let me also mention that these are, because these sums are from t equals 1 to t, these are actually computed on the new training data, and then these terms represent the estimates of those things we have from the old training data. So this is another form of the adaptation equation for the initial probabilities, and it's in terms of a component related to the new data and a component related to the previous training data. So that's how you estimate, that's how you essentially adapt a hidden Markov model on new data. And this is a pretty powerful adaptation technique. Sundar had, in his example, had a nice plot showing you a map for a scalar example. I believe here we have When MAP was first introduced, the results were pretty significant. Here we'll show results on a speech recognition task, and what we see is how performance varies as a function of the amount of training data. And what was shown is that the MAP algorithm was giving a significant improvement over the standard maximum likelihood approach with no adaptation. So here's an example where we trained the system from scratch on 2 minutes of audio data. And here's an example where we took some existing models trained on a large population, these offline, and then we adapted those models on the same 2 minutes of data. And you can see the difference in performance is pretty striking, because there's not enough data in this 2 minutes to fully train a standard model. But if you're allowed to train that model offline and adapt it on the 2 minutes of data, you can get much better performance. Now, the difference between these two numbers, you see, goes down as you have more and more new training data. So the MLE estimate converges to the MAP estimate as you get more and more data. But what this allows you to do then is to adapt these models in a short amount of time to a new speaker or new data. And that would have applications in a lot of places where you would like to be able to begin adaptation fairly quickly. For example, you talk on your cell phone and you'd like to adapt the models within a few seconds of when you start speaking, and you'd like over the course of a conversation for those models to get better. One of the interesting things that you can do with this technology, if you think about the case where you talk on a cell phone, let's say you're calling into some computer automated system and you're trying to get the system to respond to you, you can actually take your entire conversation and use that data to adapt the models. So it's not unreasonable that in a transaction you might be able to collect a few minutes worth of data. What people are particularly interested in with this kind of stuff for speech processing are adaptation, what's called rapid adaptation, which is the problem of adapting with only a few seconds worth of data, or less than a minute worth of data. And that's often what people call rapid adaptation. But when this was introduced in the mid-90s, it became a standard part of most of the speech recognition systems today. And it's all done online without any need for supervision. You don't need to know what words were actually spoken. It's all done in what's called an unsupervised way. So, did that make any sense? No? Yes? Comments? No comments. Does anybody see any application of this to some of the research that they're doing? Okay. Well, we'll have more time to talk about this next class.